Good evening and welcome to this special holiday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for Friday, November 24th, 2017. I'm Lee Robartis. On today's show, we'll hear from the Gonzaga University International Institute's quarterly Bagel and Coffee series, a panel discussion on DACA, recorded September 29th, 2017. DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which the Trump administration is trying to rapidly phase out. Among the panelists, you'll hear from Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson in this hour. Earlier this year, Ferguson was successful in getting a federal judge to issue a nationwide injunction against the first Trump travel ban.
I want to welcome all of you here this morning to the International Institute for our quarterly Bagels and Coffee series. This morning, as evidenced by the crowd, we have an especially timely topic, and that's about DACA. We've heard about it a lot in the news. We hear bits and pieces of it here and there, but our speakers who are here this morning are really going to help you understand what DACA is and how it is affecting the young Spanish speakers of this country who are undocumented and their families. As I said, this is a quarterly program. In front of you on the tables, you will see a listing of the next programs through to the end of the year. We invite you to attend any of them that you are able to. Our November program is actually going to be what we call wine and cheese as opposed to bagels and coffee because it will occur at the end of the day. And then we have other programs in between. So we are really excited about having you here. Before we actually begin the program, I'd like to invite Jonathan and Anna up here from Southwest Diner because they would like to make a quick presentation based on some fundraising they recently did for the International Institute. So come on up. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Anna. I'm not Anna. This is Anna. I'm Jonathan. We own Southwest Diner in Southwest St. Louis City. We've got a program called Peace, Love, and Breakfast Burritos where we support local charities with special programs as well as merchandise sales, which we donate the proceeds to charities we believe in or organizations we believe in. And we launched the program during our fifth anniversary party. We raised about a thousand bucks for the during the party, and with the merchandise sales, another 400 or so.
We got a check for $1,300 and some dollars.
Something like that, yeah. So I've love this organization. The more I learn about it, I hold it in even higher esteem every time I learn more about it. So happy to be here today. Thanks for the invite. I'm looking forward to the presentation.
Great.
Thank you. Yeah.
In spite of the challenges that refugee resettlement has faced this year, which, as we know, have been in the news over and over and over again, and the most recent announcement from President Trump that the admissions for this coming year will be 45,000 refugees total, compared to 85,000 2 years ago, which was supposed to be 110,000 in this current year, and which was cut to 50,000 when President Trump took office. The local scene, the local support has been tremendous. And so Southwest Diner, we thank them very much for their efforts on behalf of refugees, and we thank so many other organizations in the community and businesses that have also stepped up to be able to help us meet the gap in funding that has occurred because of the decline in refugee resettlement numbers. So thank you very much to all of you. At this point, then, I want to introduce Jim Hacking, who may not need an introduction to many of you in the room because he is a well-known speaker on the subject of immigration, media personage, etc. What I'm going to do today, particularly for the sake of time, is that I'm not going to go into great detail about our three speakers. There is on your sheet on your table also with a more complete description of them and their many ways in which they are experienced and knowledgeable about the subject that we're talking about today. The order at this point will be Jim Hacking first, then Amanda Tello will speak, and then finally Father John O'Brien will speak. Those presentations in total will take approximately 35 minutes, and then the balance of time we will have a Q&A, which I will moderate. So I'll have one question for all of them, and then we will open up questions from the audience. Let me say that because our second microphone appears to be dead now, and we had planned to pass that in the audience, that when you ask a question, ask it loud and clear, and we will try to remember to repeat it on the microphone up here because we're videotaping this session today so that it will go up quickly on our YouTube site. So without further ado, let me introduce Jim Hacking.
In 1997, I graduated from St. Louis University Law School. I went to St. Louis University High, St. Louis University, and St. Louis University Law School. In 1997, I graduated. 1998, I changed religions. I became a Muslim. 1999, I married my wife from Egypt. She and I met in law school. And 2001, we went to the Middle East. And we went to Egypt and to Jordan and to Saudi Arabia. And we got back on September 4th, 2001. I had seen the best of Islam for a whole month, and I came back, and on September 11th, my whole life changed. And it changed for many of us. And I remember immediately after September 11th, being in a room with a bunch of other Muslims. There were two doctors there, three lawyers, a reporter, and everybody was scared to death. We were literally scared that they were going to open up camps and that we were going to get interned, and we really didn't know what to do. Since that time, I left private practice and I opened up my own law firm. I wanted to be a lawyer for immigrants. And in 2007, we opened up our own firm, and I thought I could do all kinds of different law for immigrants, but the need was for immigration law. And so that's sort of what I've been focusing on for the last 10 years. And I haven't felt that fear, and I haven't sensed that fear until this January when the Muslim ban went into effect at the airport. So it's easy for me to pass as a white guy in America. So I get that. But I also understand that fear. I understand the fear that people have. I understand the fear that immigrants have. And I understand the fear of these kids that have received deferred action for childhood arrivals and how their life has now been upended by the changes to the law. I want to talk a little bit about what DACA is and, most importantly, what DACA is not. So if you go in your time machine to 2012, there was a comprehensive immigration bill put forward by the so-called Gang of Eight, which were four Democrats and four Republican U.S. senators who came up with a pretty comprehensive bill. It wasn't perfect, but it was going to allow for the undocumented people among us to get on a long, long path to citizenship. The bill passed by a wide margin in the Senate. It was set to pass in the House, and hardliners in the House refused to let it go to the floor because they knew that it would pass, and they did not want to give Barack Hussein Obama an immigration victory that would allow for the legalization of 10 or 12 million people. Frustrated with that inability to get comprehensive immigration reform passed, President Obama did the little bit that he could to try to protect the most vulnerable, the least culpable of those, and that's the children of people who came to the United States, people who came as very young children. He had a brilliant man working with him, a man that Anna and I have been on a panel with named Steve Legomski. Steve Legomski is the professor at Washington University. He literally wrote the textbook on immigration law. And so any law student around the country who's taking immigration law will use Steve's book. And Steve took a sabbatical from Washington University and he went to work as the chief counsel for the Department of Homeland Security. And Steve was really, really smart. And one of the things that dawned on him was, and he thinks about immigration all the time. If you ever talk to him, it's like, it makes my head hurt. But he recognized the fact that we do have these 12 million people in the United States, and he asked himself, well, we can't deport all these people, and I don't even think there's a political appetite to do that. What can President Obama do as an executive on the presidential side without an act of Congress? Because Congress is dysfunctional, Congress won't act. What can the president do? And what he did was he came up with priorities. And the priorities were that he would focus on people who had committed crimes and people who had repeatedly violated the immigration laws by repeatedly entering the United States. And he came up with a priority list. And at the bottom of the list were these young people, these so-called dreamers. The law that was going to be passed was called the Dream Act. And these children were known as the dreamers, the young people. And so what he did was he instituted a program called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That's what DACA stands for. And it's important to note that DACA is not a law. It is not an act of Congress. It's not something that, you know, when we study how a bill works, it wasn't that. It was just an executive order. It was just President Obama saying, I'm going to do what I can to protect these young people. And so what DACA allowed young people to do is, if they were in deportation, to temporarily halt their deportation, to put it on pause. They actually administratively closed these young people's deportation cases. Some people even had orders of deportation. It also allowed people who fit into the right categories, who came during the right time period, to get work authorization. And that was really important because for the last 10 years, many of the states have gotten very harsh on immigrants. And one of the things that they've done is made it really hard for immigrants to live in the United States and to survive and to get any kind of proof of the right to be here or you know, a license, a driver's license or anything like that, and they couldn't work. And so what DACA did was it allowed these young people to get employment authorization cards, and once they got those employment authorization cards, they could get a Social Security number, they could pay taxes, they could get a driver's license, and that was the sum total of what DACA did. It wasn't a path towards citizenship. It wasn't a path towards any kind of long-term immigration solution for these young people. But it's had a huge impact on the lives of the people that were eligible to it. Since President Obama and Steve put into effect DACA, 800,000 young people, and it's not just people from Latin America, it's people from all over the world. We have DACA clients in our office from all over. Many of them are visa overstays, so people who came as children and never went back home with their parents. And so they've been able to get work authorization. They've been able to go to school. There are now doctors and lawyers who've benefited from DACA. And so it's really been a tremendous gift to that very, very small sliver of people that that were eligible for it. President Trump, as a candidate, ran on a platform of doing away with DACA. And of doing away with and doing what he could to really make life hard on immigrants. He ran on an American First message, and he had a whole list of racially tinged events that happened during his campaign, and I don't need to go through all those for you. But I think many immigration lawyers were surprised that he didn't do away with DACA on day one, because that was one thing that he promised he was going to do. It took until this last month, September 5th, that he did finally come out and announce that they were going to do away with DACA. And there have been competing pieces of legislation. There's different bills that have been lounging around in Congress for the last 3 or 4 years. Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois and Lindsey Graham have probably the most likely bill to pass, if it's going to pass. But as things stand right now, DACA will end on March 5th, 2018. And as far as new people applying, DACA is over. So on the day that they announced it, DACA ended. And now there's people who have applications that are pending that have they're still going to get those cases processed. And there's people who, if their DACA is going to expire next year, they can apply to get that two-year extension. And so this is the end of DACA as we know it. So the one of the things that happened, and one of the reasons that I think we're at this stage right now, is after DACA was so popular, Steve Lugansky and President Obama tried to take it one step further and said, well, we're also going to change the priorities, and we're not going to deport the parents of U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents. So that was going to be a whole other class of people that President Trump and Steve believed that they could protect through executive action. That action was immediately challenged in federal court in Texas. They found the most conservative anti-Obama judge they could find. They filed a lawsuit. He got it, and he immediately stopped that deferred action plan for the parents of U.S. citizens. And 30 states joined in that lawsuit, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And that and ultimately that program was shelved and stopped. And I think that really gave a lot of momentum to the people that wanted to criticize and do away with DACA itself. And so now we have Jeff Sessions, who was the most anti-immigrant member of the Senate, now as our Attorney General. He has taken the position that DACA as it stands, as an executive order, is not defensible in court, and that therefore he's not going to defend it because all these other attorney generals that brought the original lawsuit say they're going to challenge DACA. So that's sort of where things stand. In Missouri, it's estimated that about 3,200 young people benefited from DACA. That, and if you go on numbers in St. Louis, I would imagine it's probably about 1,800 young people have benefited from DACA. And the people that I'm talking to, the people that we're dealing with, are obviously very scared. They're feeling that fear that I mentioned earlier. And it remains to be seen as to whether or not Congress is going to be able to pass this. A couple weeks ago, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer went to the Senate, went to the White House, and they came out announcing that they'd reached a deal with the president in broad strokes to sort of get this bill passed. And then President Trump the next day said he was with them, then he wasn't, and then he was. And so it still remains really unclear as to whether or not there's going to be any kind of help from Congress, because it's only a law that can really protect them. It's an executive order, as we've seen, is able to be put into place and taken out of place with the signing of a piece of paper. So in the interim, I would encourage you strongly. I just met my nice friend Yvonne, right? I just met my nice friend Yvonne, and she said one of the things about immigrants is that we don't speak up, and even naturalized citizens, we don't speak up. And we need your voice in Congress. This is one of many, many things that Congress has to deal with right now. President Trump wants to get a big tax bill in. They have to deal with the hurricanes and the effects that it's had on Puerto Rico and Florida and Texas. So, you know, there's a competing list of priorities for members of Congress, but we need people of good conscience, people who care about immigrants, to speak out and to advocate and to march and to call their members of Congress and to do what you can. And I know it sounds really easy and really like a little bitty thing, but this makes a big difference. And we have allies, and we have people that want to work with us. On that note, I have a sign-up list I've sent out. It's on a clipboard. There's two of them going around. If you want to sign up, we send out a weekly email list, email every week to our list with immigration updates if this is an important issue to you. Obviously, you don't come at 8 in the morning unless immigration is important to you. I'm really happy to be here, and with that, I'll turn it over to Amanda.
Hello. My name is Amanda Teo, and I am an organizer and programs director with and programs coordinator with Missouri Immigrant and Refugee Advocates, also known as MIRA for short. I am a member of the Latinx community, and I've also been involved with grassroots. I got my start with MIRA in 2010, and I was involved with Latinos in Action also. So I've been in this fight for immigration issues for quite a while. And so similarly to what Jim had said, I do want to talk to you about some, just what DACA is not a little bit. So although DACA did allow for many people to get work permits and visas, it is absolutely not a way to citizenship. And I think it's also important to know that these social security cards that are given to DACA recipients, they have a stamp on them that says for work authorization only. Just to give you a heads up, this is not a way. I mean, it's hard to open up a phone bill, a T-Mobile, with the type of social security card that says that. And then it's also for every 2 years, DACA has to be renewed, and there is a filing fee of $495. And again, that's every 2 years. So consider that really that's every like year and a half, because you need to at least give 6 months to be able to file for your renewal. It's also important to remember that it was never a risk-free decision to apply for DACA. So when you apply for DACA, you're handing over your banking information, your school information, your housing information, and this is for as long as you've been in the United States. So my husband is a DACA recipient, was a DACA recipient, and he has been here since he was 13. So imagine, that's every single piece of information since he was here when he was 13. And that's also every single piece of information on me as well. This is not a risk-free decision. If your application is denied, you risk deportation. If you do not have the funds to renew your DACA, you risk deportation. If it's taken away, like what's happening, you risk deportation. This has never been a risk-free decision, and it's something that should be considered. And so also, it's not a risk-free decision for the families of DACA recipients. Again, you're giving out information on housing. So this might include your parents' information, your aunt's information, your sister and brother's information. And if they weren't lucky enough to qualify for DACA, now they're also exposed. So as I said, my husband had DACA. It's also important to understand that not all DACA recipients are students. So although when you applied for DACA, you had some sort of, maybe you had gone to school, you had gone to English classes, you had gotten a GED, it doesn't mean that you're in school forever for the rest of your life. And that's not, that isn't, let me just stop for a second. I can tell you right now that I'm pregnant and half of my words like don't exist in my head anymore. They've just gone somewhere else in the universe. So going back. So they're not all students. It's not realistic for everybody. It wasn't realistic for my husband. So some of the things that we push against at MIRA and a lot of DACA recipients have pushed against is the naming of DACA students, because it's not inclusive. And it really leaves out the workforce that's not able to continue with school. And then also, it's extremely important to remember that the legislation that we're looking at MIRA, that we're pushing for at MIRA, that we're advocating for at MIRA, and that is being advocated by documented folks and by their families, is to be inclusive to all 12 million undocumented. DACA was something that was successful for a few, but as Jim had pointed out, it left out a whole lot of other people. And so what we want is reform that's going to be inclusive for that entire group. It's also important to consider the dangerous narrative to the parents and families of anyone that's documented when you say they came here at no fault of their own. by saying that it criminalizes the parents. And that's exactly, we're not looking for a scapegoat in this. We want to include them in this reform. So be mindful of the narratives that you're putting out about documented students and also this, but they came here at no fault of their own. And I kind of want to move in a little bit of another direction and just talk about what services are available in St. Louis for documented. We have Mo Dreamers. This is an organization that's run by documented folks. So if you know people who have DACA who are wanting to connect with other DACA recipients, please let me know and I can connect you with the Mo Dreamers. We also have in the area both St. Francis Community Services and Kingdom House that offer a wide variety of services that include case management and therapy. The Scholarship Foundation has opportunities for scholarships, and this is an important thing because in Missouri, a lot of the documented students are being charged international rates to attend colleges that they might have lived by their entire lives, and this has to do with Missouri law. And so there's a lot that's going on in St. Louis to help documented folks, but I would say that it's not enough, and I would urge you to continue to push your representatives and local elected officials, and this includes even the mayor, to support a community who is resilient and strong but is hurting right now. I'd consider you to push them to be more public on their statements in support of DACA and also to go and push for legislation that is inclusive for everybody in the city. And then be considerate of the few things that I've discussed, which is harmful language around this subject. So again, the documented students, only focusing on students. It puts out an idea that you're only worthy if you have an education, and that's absolutely not true. Or that you're only worthy if you have if you've given economically. So another aspect that we go on a lot of times is what have immigrants and what have documented provided for the city economically. And again, those are great statistics and facts to know, but that shouldn't be the reason why you support documented and immigrants. Also, just to reiterate, criminalizing parents. Be very careful of the language that you use around that. Another one that's been coming up a lot lately to support documented is we are all immigrants. And that can sometimes, actually not sometimes, it does erase the stories of people who are immigrants and who have immigrated here. I myself am not an immigrant. I've been in Missouri most of my life. I've never had to learn another language. I've never been separated from family because I had to be. So for me personally, and to have seen the struggles that my husband has gone through, that's something I feel very strongly about. We don't want to ever erase the stories of somebody who has had to struggle through the immigration system and through moving and through separation of families, that it's unfair for them. Another type of language that we push to be careful around is the voices for the voiceless. It's the idea that the documented community is voiceless, and they're not voiceless. There's a whole lot of documented folks that have been standing up. They're here. It's just a matter of connecting with them. Again, Mo Dreamers is a good way to go about that. So that's another thing, is if you know documented folks, make those connections to these services that I've discussed, IFCLA, Kingdom House, the Scholarship Foundation, Mo Dreamers. If you know somebody else that has DACA and you just know that they don't know each other, maybe introduce them. Making those connections can be very valuable to the community. And then, of course, You can also donate to advocacy groups that are pushing and fighting for legislation reform. And that's all I got for y'all today. But thank you.
You're listening to the Gonzaga University International Institute's quarterly Bagel and Coffee series and their panel discussion on DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, recorded September 29th, 2017 in Spokane. This is the KRFP Evening Report, special holiday weekend edition.
KRFP is supported by
Panhandle Artisan Bakery, baking naturally leavened bread using local ingredients. Panhandle Artisan Bakery is located at 630 North Almond Street, Suite 110, and panhandlebread.com on the web.
KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including peace and human rights.
KRFP. Moscow.
So I want to reaffirm and agree with everything that Jim and Amanda said. Thank you so much for those words and that information. That's so important. And what I want to kind of center on is something that a lot of people feel like there's nothing I can do. I'm not a lawyer. I don't work directly in advocacy. There's nothing I can do to change the immigration case of a particular person. I'm not a politician. But there's an enormous amount that each of us can do in terms of accompaniment and emotional and spiritual support. So this, I'm not going to go into all the details about the sorts of programs that we do in the parish or in the diocese, but just in general, this can mean a variety of things. Providing transportation for folks. Providing company for people as they go to accomplish different errands, from going to the market, taking their kids to school, going to the courthouse to file something, or even something heavier, right? This includes also emotional and spiritual support. Building bridges with folks who are undocumented. Knowing who they are. Finding out what their needs are. And then I would also add having the courage to raise our voices in their support and stand up in their defense. And that's very important. And along these lines, I just want to provide how this has been made real for me and in a personal way. So I've been at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish, this is my third year, and I've always spoken in favor of the immigrant community, in favor of an immigration reform. I've always spoken in support of immigrants, and my parish is 90% immigrant. So they know that I support them. But something happened at the beginning of this past August. And things started to change somewhat dramatically, all of a sudden. It seemed to me as if this tension that had been building, this tension of racism, of bigotry, of anti-immigrant sentiment, and some of the policies of the new president that have started to unfold, all of a sudden started to break loose. And I saw this manifested in a flood of really heartbreaking deportation cases, detentions, arrests, and racial profiling among my parishioners. It all seemed to happen right around the same time. And so for 2 weeks at the beginning of August, I was trying to follow these cases and do what I could to support these folks, most of whom happen to be young people. And some of them, two of them, DACA applicants. One of them was reapplying or was renewing his DACA status when he was apprehended and detained and sent to prison without fianza, how do you say that? A bond for 6 weeks. But what broke my heart about these situations wasn't just the arrests and the detentions and the deportations, but it was how my folks were being treated during the process. One young girl from my parish was left with bruises and marks on her body as the law enforcement attempted to arrest her for suspicion of being undocumented. And then later on they discovered she was born in this country. Others, law enforcement, ICE officials, would frequently taunt them, make fun of them, belittle them, humiliate them, say things to embarrass them or make them feel worthless during this process of transportation and detention. As if it's not bad enough to be arrested. And these are folks who had never committed a crime. They never committed a crime. And so I shuddered to think how they would have been treated if the law enforcement had suspected that indeed they may have committed a crime. Anyway, so I was upset and discouraged, and I felt helpless. So I decided just to do something simple and direct. And I took a principle that I learned from years of pastoral counseling. And that is, before we can have healing and recovery, we first need to recognize and denounce the evil affliction. So I thought, well, let's start there. So on August 20th, I stood before my community at the January Wabash Park in Ferguson. It was our annual Hispanic festival, and we had an outdoor mass. And during the sermon, I just simply went down the litany of the many different expressions of racism and bigotry and hatred and anti-immigrant sentiment that we've been experiencing of late, many of which were born out of the presidential campaign. And I denounced them. And I said that this was evil. I mentioned different actions of the president, different inactions of the president and other politicians, and our own silence and indifference before everything that's happening. And said, this is evil, this is wrong, this is hurting us, this is an affront to humanity, to human dignity. And simply that. That I was not going to stop raising my voice and stop standing up until things changed. Because I love them too much to shirk my responsibility. And that I invited everybody, and there were English speakers there as well, there was everybody there, to join us in denouncing evil and supporting the good. And that the following week I would have a list. I would enumerate a list of ways in which all of us in the community and anybody who wants can participate in support of our immigrant community. And so one of the fundamental ways of this has been accompaniment. So after the Mass, one of the native English speakers of the community came up to me and he said, Father, I mean, no offense to your years of service at Guadalupe, but I think that your ministry actually started today. And I'm with you 100%. So then I went down and I sat down to enjoy my tacos, right? Because it's a Hispanic festival. What do? You eat tacos. And a crowd started to form of my familiar Hispanic parishioners, people that I know well. But in that moment, they started sharing with me stories that they'd never shared with me before. They started telling me things that they'd never told me before. They started treating me differently. And one gentleman said, Padre, quiero que nos diga la verdad. Verdaderamente, no como pastor, padre, sino como ser humano. ¿Verdaderamente nos quiere como hispanos? He says, Father, I want you to tell me the truth. Not as our pastor, not as a priest, as a human being. Do you really love us as Hispanics? I felt in that moment as if I had crossed over to another dimension of trust, you know what I mean? And from that moment, things have begun to change. I'm busier, but and things in many respects aren't improving. But at the same time, I sense that a lot of folks feel the reassurance, the support, and the confidence that they need to move through this. And we will move through this. Like I told my folks, the Lord is suffering within us, but at the end there's victory, and He will be victorious in us. This is the effect of accompaniment. This is the effect of journeying with our brothers and sisters during this difficult time that they're experiencing in their lives and the lives of many in our country. These DACA students in particular, and if I could just expand it, because I know we're talking about DACA students, but you know, we're talking about all immigrants. But if we were just to expand it to young immigrants, these folks desperately need our support. Emotional support, spiritual support. Because it's an extremely demoralizing thing that happened when DACA was revoked. And it was symbolically demoralizing to all of us. So they need to know that we support them. They need to know that we're proud of them. They need to know that we're on their side. That we care about them. And that we'll do what it takes to put ourselves forward, to put ourselves on the line, and defend them. If we open ourselves up to accompaniment, we will be able to produce the kind of communion and trust and confidence that we need. Thank you.
Whether it's Jim, there's anything else that you'd like to add now that they've heard the other presentation?
Thank you.
very much. I was dying to do that. Until September 5th, nothing had really changed. Fundamentally, our immigration laws had not changed. The day-to-day rules and regulations of the federal government as it relates to immigration had not changed. And September 5th was a change, but it's not a monumental change. The things that I want to add are twofold. Number one, DACA and advocating for Dreamers is important for all the reasons that we discussed, but that is breadcrumbs. This is breadcrumbs. We are thinking too small. We are playing too much defense. What we need is something much bigger, a vision, a purpose, something much larger, and that is real comprehensive immigration reform to help these people get out of the shadows and be able to be fully engaged in life in America. And you'll hear people talk about the economics of that, about, oh, well, it's just going to be so great for the economy, and we're going to save the baby boomers who are all retiring, and we're going to have all these great Hispanic, Latino people be able to work for us and do all these jobs. That's nothing. This is about humanity. This is about people's lives. These are human beings. So throw the economic stuff out, and as the father said, do it because it's right. The other thing that I want to mention is that we cannot ignore the money involved in the current system. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement, these guys are off the chain. They hated President Obama because they thought that they weren't being able to deport enough people. And they have been emboldened by their new president. They took the unprecedented, their union took the unprecedented step of endorsing a presidential candidate for the first time in their history. This is job security for them. They have quotas that they have to meet. There are private prisons that have beds that have to be filled. There is a ton of money in the way that things are right now. And what we need to do, what our job to do as advocates, what I think the number one thing that I do, other than being an immigration lawyer, is dragging what's being done in the dark out into the light. And what's going on, if you pay attention to it, is scary. And I would encourage everybody to focus for now on ICE. Focus on... Thank you. Focus on ICE. Watch what they're doing. Do not look over here when ICE is where you need to focus. Last week, they grabbed a mom and dad who had brought their child across the border to get medical treatment in Texas. And they arrested them while the child was getting medical treatment. This is what they're doing. And as Father said, they're loving it. They're laughing at it. This is what they've been dying for. This is their dream. They are unchained. And it's time to chain them back up.
I second everything Jim said. But further, I just think it's really important to understand that this is an issue that's happening in St. Louis, and a lot of times it's in the dark or swept under the rug. There's this idea that deportations are not happening here, and that is absolutely not true. They're happening all of the time. There are fewer immigrants in the city, so maybe it's not expressed as often, and also that the communities are spread out. But this is on a daily basis. There was an ICE detained somebody just a few days ago and mentioned to the person that they were coming for everybody with records. There was issues in Festus just a few weeks ago where a car was pulled over literally on the assumption that they were immigrants and then detained. So this is an issue that's happening in St. Louis, and you should be mindful, and you should know where the ICE building is. It's at 1222 Spruce. Write that down so you know where it is. And be aware of how the system is working and who's involved in this system and where are the detention facilities. We don't have them in St. Louis particularly, but where do people go when they put them somewhere? They go to Montgomery. There's all these different... The system is big, and it's working in Missouri, and it's working quite well. And a lot of us just have no idea. We don't know where it is, and we don't know who's running the detention centers. And these are all things. So I would urge you and suggest to go home and not just listen to what's being told, but do some homework and some digging on your own to find out who are these key players and who do you need to target and who do you need to stand up against.
I would just add, agree with all that, and add, don't back down. And keep informed. Thanks for Jim's newsletter, and all those things are very helpful. In a religious, faith-based framework, what I like to keep emphasizing is human dignity. Because there are a lot of other themes out there. People say to me, what about laws? Are we anarchists? Don't we believe in laws? And I say, yeah, we believe in laws. But human dignity supersedes human law. And what we're saying is these laws need to change in order to be in agreement with human dignity and justice. Know the realities, as our other speakers have been saying. One gentleman wrote me an email after I was quoted in a newspaper, and I must have said something about anti-immigrant sentiment. And he said, I'm tired of hearing this from you religious people. There's no anti-immigrant sentiment. There's only anti-illegal immigrant sentiment. As if that particular variety of contempt for another human being is somehow acceptable. But I have to say to him, I'm sorry. Obviously, our pastoral experiences are wildly different because there's a very strong anti-immigrant sentiment out there. And I've seen it. I think we need to keep those facts at the forefront, because it helps in defeating these lies that are out there.
All right, we appear to have a mic that works. And so if you raise your hand, I saw a hand in pink back there. If you raise your hand, then the mic will come to you, and you can ask your question.
Hi. Yeah, I have one practical question and one, I don't know whether it's practical or not. I've been getting emails asking me to donate this $495 for DACA applicant for renewal of status. What is the means by which, if you want to support that, where is the best way to give that, through what organization or organizations? That's the first question. And the second is, have the church made any plans that anyone knows of to specifically be sanctuaries that would prevent people from getting arrested and detained and deported? I mean, I don't mean this in general global sense, which liberals and progressives love to say, but I mean specifically, like you can come here and there'll be food and shelter. Is there any of that going on in St. Louis?
Okay, in St. Louis, currently, to my knowledge, we have two Missouri Immigrant and Refugee Advocates. We collect for the fundings, and also IFGLA. And I'm really sorry, but I can never remember what their full name is. Like, Interfaith
Community Latin America.
There you go. I can't ever remember that. See. Interfaith, what is it?
Interfaith Community.
Interfaith Committee for Latin America. And Missouri Immigrant and Refugee Advocates. If you just donate, and you can like make a note that it's for, and you know, for however much you can, that it goes to that. We're working with attorneys, and they will get those funds. It's on a first come first served basis, so there's no requirement or anything like that. It's just whoever shows up and whoever needs it.
Okay.
We're doing our DACA renewals for free right now to help people get that done by October 5th. And there's a group, I'm looking for them now. The website is lc4daca.org, and it's the Mission Asset Fund, and they've set aside $1 million, half of which will go to students or young people in California, and the other half for people around the country. And they'll turn around a check in 24 hours for people to get these filing fees done by October 5th. I don't think they've run out of money yet. And I know I read something on Facebook yesterday. There's a similar group. It might be United We Dream here in St. Louis that's doing that too.
Sanctuaries? I think the sanctuary issue is kind of new and still developing. There are churches in the region that do provide sanctuary, and there are sanctuaries that are sanctuary arrangements and situations that are more low profile for different reasons. And what else can I say about that? Let me just point out Leticia Seitz, who's up here at the table. Leticia, can you wave? She's in charge of Latinos en Acción, and also is a member of my parish and is the director of the St. Toribio Ministries, social justice ministries that we have in the parish. We deal with these kinds of questions all the time. So she's an excellent resource. Lots of people are excellent resources for how to find shelter for folks who are in need of shelter, you know, whether that means sanctuary or something more temporary or anything in between.
Let me also, before somebody asks the question, give a little bit of background on the question of whether St. Louis can be a sanctuary city, for instance. Missouri law prohibits right now any city in the state designating itself as a sanctuary city. So that's on the books in terms of Missouri law. It doesn't mean in some areas of the country where there are these laws on the books that cities have not defied the law and gone ahead and designated themselves as such. And you will have seen then the response from the White House with regard to taking action, threatening to withhold federal funding from those cities or their states, etc. Those are generally states that or cities that have significant numbers of undocumented at this point, and a financial base that really demands that they take this kind of action far and beyond the obvious humanitarian aspect and need for it. But before you ask the question right now, it's on the books in Missouri that no one, no state, no city can actually be a sanctuary city. So next question, down here in front, Kelly's coming with a mic.
Thank you. My name is Tonya.
Hold it closer, will you?
Thank you. So I guess my question is, what can local officials do? What can state officials do? How can citizens hold their elected officials accountable? Because what really strikes me about Missouri is that what I keep hearing is, well, the immigrant population here is so small. It doesn't matter. Having a clear path to citizenship as a first generation American is also means a lie when it would be here to live and survive, because my parents have very clear path to citizenship. So what can people do, and what can the state do, what can local officials do to make sure that we have something in place to protect people of Missouri, to protect people who need to have something to keep them safe in the meantime, even if it's not happening at the national level as yet. So I guess James, maybe this starts this question first.
The tough thing is there's this little thing in the Constitution called the Supremacy Clause, and the Supremacy Clause says that federal law governs. So states like California and cities like Chicago and San Francisco have all tried to take measures, but ultimately federal law prevails. So the focus, I believe, if you want to talk about long-term solutions, has to be on Congress. So we have a Senate race in Missouri right now. On the local level, I mean, first of all, in Missouri, you're the most politicians in Missouri
try to outdo themselves in how anti-immigrant they can be. So the idea that we're going to be able to get real change with the gerrymandered districts that we have and the unlimited money that we have flowing into state and federal politics, I think is not going to happen. So I think that the focus really should be on federal races, Congress and Senate, and just pushing those people to be as pro-immigrant as we can get them to be.
I'm just going to add something real quick. I think it's important to keep note of like what the Democratic representatives are saying. Like, for instance, when Lida ran, she ran on a platform that she wanted to push the city to be a sanctuary city. So it's good to follow their voting patterns, what they voted for in the past, and how can you continue to push them to be allies for the community, or to keep them accountable for the actions that they said that they were going to do.
My name is Nigel Holloway. There's a lot of hatred out there, but there's also a lot of love. And I wonder whether there are any practical or other lessons to be learned from the movement to institute same-sex marriage and LGBTQIA rights. Any of the lessons that could be learned for what we're talking about today. A few years ago, nobody would have ever thought that we would have the United States, but we do have it now. So a lot of things are unimaginable, but because of the ethical component, the understanding by the majority of citizens here that same-sex marriage is a good thing, and an ethical thing that it came about. And for the same reasons, the ethical arguments are so strong for people who live here, whether they're undocumented or otherwise, to be treated with dignity. Surely the same thing could happen for the immigration debate.
There has not been, in my experience, such a sea change as happened with regard to same-sex marriages. I mean, I had clients that came to see me that wanted to get married and sponsor their partner for a benefit, and I told them, no way. And 2 years later, they were in my office and we filed and we actually got some of the first cases approved in St. Louis. So I think the lessons to be learned are tremendous, and I think that the community in support of same-sex marriages was very organized, very vocal, very much telling stories, very good at telling stories, and you know, I think that our voices get drowned out in the immigration debate. I think that, you know, It's hard to get the message out of the ethic. I mean, I was tearing up when Father was telling his story. Those are the kinds of stories that we need to tell. I mean, the idea of people at that picnic feeling connected to him in a new way because of he shared, you know, the stories of vulnerability, the stories of what's happening. I mean, that's how you connect with people. This is going to have to be one in the heart. And I think that some of the sad stories that came out of the same-sex arguments are the kinds of things that we can do here.
All right, final question. Back there. Carolyn. Well, oh, all right.
My name is Lucila. I work for Sunday Spotify's teams. Having had the experience with the information that I have with the applications, and they are even scared to apply for benefits for the citizen children, like wheat or food stamps, is there any law that protects that those families or the agencies or ICE could use that information against the families?
No, absolutely not. It's certainly not in Missouri. But, you know, that's sort of the sanctuary argument, is that the different states and local municipalities are saying we're not going to share information with ICE. But on a federal level, Jeff Sessions and Trump would be outraged to hear if there was a state saying that we're not going to share that information. That's one of the problems with DACA. I'm sure that when Steve and President Obama came up with DACA, they never envisioned a presidency like this. And ICE has said
2 weeks ago very clearly that they plan on sharing, getting the information from USCIS. So remember, after 9/11, they split INS into two parts, USCIS, which is the nice part of immigration where you apply for benefits, including DACA, and then ICE, which is the enforcement side. ICE has specifically said now, and USCIS has also said, that they're going to share all that DACA information. So the sharing of information in this world we live in, where data is so important and so easily accessed, that they're absolutely going to use things, everything that they can. I mean, that's one of the crazy things about immigration enforcement right now is they are getting people when they go to pay their traffic ticket. They're getting people if they go to a house and there's one person, they'll just grab everybody. Like Father said, they even grab U.S. citizens. And this is the kind of stuff that we're talking about. This is about what I mean when I say that they're off the chain, is that they just feel as if they have no limits. So any state or municipality that tried to say you can't use WIC applications or anything like that, that would ICE is going to ignore that.
This would be a good opportunity to bring Know Your Rights presentations to the community. MIRA does do Know Your Rights presentations, but it's really vital right now, and even to suggest getting like the little chain locks, because they don't have to open their door when ICE comes, but it's just having those conversations over and over and over again, and even putting it into practice before it comes down to actually happening.
Yeah, I wanted just to mention that I received an announcement yesterday that there will be a Know Your Rights session on the 15th of November, I believe it is, at the Center for Global Understanding at St. Louis University, organized by Congressman Clay. And there will be speakers there that will talk specifically about some of the legality and also recommendations with regards to how to be able to protect people that you know, or for them to protect themselves. And so for anyone that's interested, I urge you to go online, I assume at Congressman Clay's website or at St. Louis University's calendar of events to learn more about that. Unfortunately, we're going to have to cut this off now since it is 9:15, and I promise that would be the end. The formal end, but I assume that the speakers will have a few minutes to be able to stay around afterwards so that any of you who had questions that you haven't had a chance to have answered yet can approach them and discuss. I want to thank all of you for attending this morning. I learned a lot, and I hope you did too. And as I said, take the upcoming event sheet with you, and we hope to see you back here another time this fall. Thanks a lot.
That was the Gonzaga University International Institute's quarterly bagel and coffee series and their panel discussion on DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, recorded September 29th in Spokane. Among the speakers was Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who was successful in getting a federal judge to issue a nationwide injunction against the first Trump travel ban. That's it for this special holiday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great holiday weekend.